It's best known for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. It was an event many credit for the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. We'll hear from Reverend Milton Cole Duval of West Des Moines. 50 years ago, he attended the march when he was 19. Also, former Iowa State Representative Wayne Ford's memories of the march as a boy growing up in Washington, D.C. Then we'll be joined by Keisho Scott of Grinnell College. Scott is a former Black Panther. She'll give us her reflections on this anniversary. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Originally for today's show, we had planned to discuss both a new batch of recordings, secret recordings by President Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, a new batch that was released recently, and also hear reflections on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Well, as it turns out, we have so many insightful guests to talk about the March on Washington that we'd like to devote the full hour to that. Our conversation with Dennis Goldford of Drake University about the Nixon tapes will be postponed until Thursday of this week. Well, as you've all heard, we've been marking the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech. In just a moment, we'll hear from an Iowan who took part in that march. But first, let's hear from Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University. I spoke with him earlier today and began by asking him what more recent political developments say about the degree to which Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream has been achieved.
Well, you know, we've at one level come a long way since 1963. I tell my students sometimes about the remarkable things you did or did not see on television back then, about the kinds of contacts you'd have between white Americans and Black Americans, and there was a kind of de facto, if not segregation, at least a separateness in terms of what people did back then. And so we've in many ways come a long way, but as people often say, there's still a distance to go.
Now, a moment of full irony is clear for the president's speech tomorrow. He'll be the nation's first African-American president, standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, where Martin Luther King Jr. and many other speakers stood 50 years earlier for that March on Washington. But speaking tomorrow at a time when many African-Americans and other minorities feel that the Voting Rights Act, one of the proudest accomplishments of that civil rights movement, is being dismantled. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there's some complicated constitutional aspects to that. The court basically said, perhaps knowing that with the current partisan division in Congress, Congress is not actually going to do anything. But the court said, look, the criteria you used for what would trigger a special scrutiny of various voting practices and procedures is way out of date. It criteria that were, in fact, enforced and developed 50 years ago. Congress needs to use more contemporary data, more contemporary information about conditions regarding voting procedures and possible discriminatory effect. At the same time, symbolically, certainly a lot of African Americans and supporters among other groups saw that as an assault on the principle of the Voting Rights Act, an act which perhaps more than anything else, change the nature of politics in the South and the country as a whole.
Inevitably, comparisons occur between Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama. I wonder, how do you compare them in your mind?
Well, to some extent, it's apples and oranges. I mean, we can say certainly that what Martin Luther King did, and starting even before that famous speech in Washington, but that, of course, was an amazing speech. It's a speech that gives me chills to this day every time I hear it. He prepared, and those events prepared the way for a Barack Obama. But Martin Luther King, whatever his private moral difficulties and moral failings, was certainly publicly a moral leader. And he's not someone who had to govern, whereas Barack Obama is someone who has to govern. And we think of how partisan our environment is today, and it certainly is. There were tremendous divisions. There were less partisan divisions back then, but sectional divisions. The South felt under assault by the rest of the country. And in fact, a higher percentage of Republicans in Congress voted in favor of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and Voting Rights Act of 65 than did Democrats, because there were an awful lot of Southern segregationist Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their political descendants, they don't support segregation anymore, but their political descendants are all Republicans now. The South has changed from the Solid South Democratic to the Solid South Republican. But all those events really made Barack Obama possible now. But it's a difference between a moral leader and someone who's supposed to be a political leader.
You said parts of that speech give you chills even today, 50 years later, as they do many Americans. Specifically, what part of the speech is the high point for you?
The content of their character, that particular segment. You know, Martin Luther King was pilloried, especially by opponents in the South, as a communist and a socialist and things like that. But if you look carefully at the speech and the letter from the Birmingham jail, you know, he wasn't saying overthrow the country, overthrow the government. He was saying, look at the promise of America contained in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, and realize, make real that promise. So he was asking us not to change our system, but to live up to the very ideals at the foundation of our system. So it's masterful as a speech, in the sense of a speech that is something that will move people.
Dennis Goldford, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Professor of Politics at Drake University. We'll talk to you again soon.
Sure enough.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking 50 years ago this week in August of 1963 during the March on Washington. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me now, Reverend Milton Cole Duval of West Des Moines. He's in our Des Moines studio. Good afternoon to you, Reverend.
Good afternoon to you.
You attended this march 50 years ago. You were a 19-year-old college student. I believe you'd completed your freshman year at the College of William and Mary. Why did you decide to go? What prompted you?
I was working public works. I was picking up garbage alongside the highway in Virginia and became friends with Eli, whose parents taught at a historically black Hampton Institute. And Eli said, are you going to Washington week after next? I said, what for? He said, there are people that are going to gather because they want justice and they're going to be talking about civil rights. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, how many people do you think are going to go? He said, I heard this is going to be like between 5 and 10,000 people. I said, Lord, that's a lot of folk. I don't know if I can go or not. I knew I was not going to ask my parents because my parents would say adamantly no.
What? Because they were afraid for your safety or
they
why?
Were afraid. People were fearful. 10,000 black people coming together. People in the South thought that would be nothing but trouble.
Now, Eli, you tell the story. Eli, was he an African-American?
He was an African-American.
You are not.
I have no color.
You have no color. Did that give you any pause when he asked you that?
I've always, from the sixth grade, when we had a mock election and 24 people voted for Ike and I voted for Adlai Stevenson, much of my life I've marched to the beat of a different drum.
Okay. Your expectations going into the march, you nervous about attending, hearing that, well, we know from news reports looking back that there was the expectation of possible violence, often talked about in the media.
I knew that if I was traveling with my friend Eli, I was all right.
You did.
I was more excited than fearful.
What about the trip there? How did you get there?
We drove up. We left in the early morn, about 4 o'clock that morning. I told my parents I was going to Virginia Beach. Oftentimes it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission.
Right.
So I didn't tell them what was really transpiring, and we got up early and we drove up to D.C., arrived early in the morn. In those days, Washington, though a vibrant city in our country, was a quiet little southern town. People had not gone to work that day. People had been dismissed from their jobs for the day because employers and business people and government officials in Washington were fearful with that onslaught of black people from the South. So the whole town, sleepy little southern town, shut down.
Did you, Reverend Coldeval, have a sense that where you were going, what was about to happen was historic, or did that only occur to people later?
Oh, I think you knew it was important. I'll speak for myself. I knew for me it was important to be there. In retrospect, it refined me. Civil rights, social justice have become, along with my family, have become the passions of my life. But in terms of people know what was really, how significant it was going to be, I think even the big six civil rights people, Dr. King, Roy Wilkins, John Lewis, A. Philip Randolph, they didn't know how magnificent, magnanimous this would ultimately be.
Now that day, August 28th, 1963, a particularly hot day.
You could walk out of your studio now, out onto the streets in Iowa City, close your eyes, and you could have been at the march.
That's how hot it was.
It was hot. And that part of D.C. is below sea level. It's known as Foggy Bottom. It's near the Watergate, near the memorial to President Lincoln. And historically, it was a place that was unsettled. It was very mosquito-laden. So it's a very, very hot part of the District of Columbia.
Tell me about a moment or two that stood out for you during that march when you had arrived there in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
Well, I was close by to Eli all the time. I didn't know other people there. People spoke. You might introduce yourself. You'd strike up a conversation. I conversed with a woman from Birmingham, Alabama. She told me she had ridden for 24 hours and how much it cost. And I remember another person asking somebody, did you fly in or ride the bus? And this man said, Lord, child, we've been used to riding buses our whole lives. We don't know anything about flying. So you knew it was important. You knew it was significant. You knew it was hot. And you knew it was the place you had to be.
Is there an image that stands out in your memory when you think one image of that moment, that time, that day?
Well, the crescendo of the gathering was when Dr. King spoke. But up to that time, there was music. I remember Marian Anderson singing the national anthem. I recalled that she had not been allowed to sing at the Daughters of the American Constitution Hall, D.A.R. Hall, Constitution Hall. I mean, I had known that from growing up. And when she sang at the Lincoln Memorial. So to be there when she sang later the national anthem, to see all these people that having grown up with an awareness of the civil rights movement, these giant of men was significant. But the crescendo was when Dr. King spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And when he talked about the imagery of black children, white children, hand in hand playing, when he talked about Georgia, when he talked about Mississippi, when he talked about Alabama, when we sang, there were times when you would all of a sudden a hand beside you would grasp your hand. We knew that we were all in this together, that we all had a commitment to seeing the United States be what the promises had said we would ultimately become.
We get a chill listening to the Reverend Martin Luther King in that historic speech. Listening to it now, did you have a spill, a chill, when you perhaps had a hold of someone's hand and you heard those words live?
It never grows old. It never grows stale. It's alive. It's vibrant because it's a vision that Dr. King had in the speech and that he shared with all of us, and we too can own, inculcate, and move on that vision.
Reverend Milton Cole Duval of West Des Moines is with us. He attended the march 50 years ago in Washington, D.C., that famous gathering where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. Also joining us, former State Representative Wayne Ford in our Des Moines studio. Wayne Ford, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Now, you didn't attend the march, but you were 11 years old, if I'm getting this right. You were living in Washington, D.C. when it occurred. What do you remember about late August 1963 and that gathering?
Well, as the Reverend said, it was always hot. D.C. is a very hot city, and I do remember that. But what was so profound to me was everybody was dressed up. If you look at the pictures now, it's probably one of the few pictures of a public gathering that large where the majority of people had suits and ties on. And I remember as a kid watching it on TV and hearing about what my people were saying, because a lot of my friends and older people, they went. I was just a little kid. But everybody was dressed up. D.C. is already hot and humid. But what it clearly shows me, the formality of dealing with the issue of race, the formality of that. If you took a picture of that march and everybody, black and white, everybody had suits and ties on and coats. And if you look at a picture of a public march now, it's a different tone, a different time. So I guess the major thing I remember is that everybody had suits and ties on and they was excited. And although it was real hot, when people came back and told me what happened, nobody was upset about the heat as though they was involved with something very spiritual. No one told me how hot it was because it was something more historical than that.
Mm-hmm. So what were you actually doing during the march when people were gathering, speaking on the National Mall there?
Well, going back, I was a kid, but I remember looking at that on TV. Looking at it on TV because I remember my family members, they left early in the day, and they was all dressed up. So, and again, only speaking from as a kid, the impact was tremendous. But as a little kid looking at all this, I knew it was something formal. D.C. was a very segregated city. At that time, I was living in Northeast Washington, and that's one of the few places in the country at that time where you had a high school, elementary school, vocational school, and middle school all in the same area because blacks were segregated in Washington, D.C. And I grew up in Northeast Washington, Trinidad, Maryland Avenue neighborhood. Those same schools are still there today. But it was the only place, I think, in the country at that time that had you could stay in that same neighborhood from birth all the way up to going to college. And you would have to never move because at that time it had to be said, we'll keep the Negroes in this part of town.
Mm-hmm. So even at the age of 11, you knew. Did you feel there was a lot of racism in this country, in Washington, D.C., in your neighborhood?
No, because if you don't know, you don't know no better. Again, I thought that, you know, how would I know everything? The store, the police, everybody was black. My teachers were black. I had no idea about segregation from that perspective. I only knew about that when I went to North Carolina to visit my grandmother.
What happened there?
And sometimes she would point out, she saw some people who she knew who lived behind her. And then she would tell me one summer we saw them, and then we never saw those people again. It was always the same. Some type of something was going on. I remember going to the train station in Wilson, North Carolina, and that was a classic train station right there because it shows you clearly. Blacks sat on one side of the train station and whites sat on one side of the train station. When you got to those train stations, your grandparents told you where to go. There was the colored water fountain, the colored bathroom, and the white people had theirs on the other side. I never knew how the white people's situation looked because I never in my life went inside of it. So I had an idea of the South being segregated. But Washington, D.C. was a strange city. I didn't know until many years later that there were stores downtown that black people could not go in into the 50s and 60s. You could not walk into those stores. I didn't know about that. So I was a young kid. Remember now, I was 11 years old, and I was already in a neighborhood. Everybody was black. We had our own school system. I thought that everything was okay. I didn't know no better.
Mm-hmm. You said everybody was dressed up. That's what stands out in your memory. But Washington, D.C. had prepared for violent outbursts at this time, possibly. No arrests were, in fact, made in relation to the march. Do you remember that tension in the city or your home or your neighborhood?
No, that's way before the Black Panthers. That's way before a lot of situations happened in California. You remember the race riots really started much later in 68, 69, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. That whole situation, Watts riots and all that. But before that time, I used to tell people this, that, I mean, it was a quiet time, a formal time. Here you are going to one of the greatest marches that ever was up to that point, and people had suits and ties on. Even you look at those pictures today, you see clearly the suits and ties. Harry Bonifani, Sammy Davis Jr., that was the first time that I saw black and white celebrities together, walking down the street together. The impact of that, Anthony Quinn, I can go on and on and on. Frank Sinatra, they touched each other. They sent a strong message. So the situation of race riots and all that, I was too young to understand even the possibility of that at that time.
When you went back to school the day after that march, or whenever you did go back to school, I guess maybe school hadn't resumed yet, did it change you? Did it change your classmates? Did you talk about it?
Well, it changed me to a certain degree. Let's say we talked about it. Again, I was a young kid, but it had a profound effect on who I have become today. You know, you say I was a state legislator. I've served longer as a legislator here in Iowa than any black in the history of Iowa. And when I came here to play football many years ago to Drake and found out that and during this time and back in the 1800s, when they were hanging blacks for education in the South, blacks and whites were going to school here in Iowa. So, and also I recognized that in 1863, they did a law, the Supreme Court passed a law that black men could run for office way before Representative Ford was born. So I guess, ironically, I saw a visual of a great historical march on TV, and many years later, I become a black leader in the fifth whitest state in America. And the essence of all of that was there was no riots. There was people being very formal, Hollywood stars and black people coming together. So I think a lot of my essence, a lot of my community spirit started during that time.
Okay. Former State Representative Wayne Ford is with us, indeed, the longest-serving African-American in the state legislature from 1997 to 2010. We're so glad to have him in our Des Moines studio, along with the Reverend Milton Cole Duvall of West Des Moines, remembering the March on Washington 50 years ago this week. Gentlemen, please stay with us, and when we come back, we'll also be joined by Professor Keisho Scott of Grinnell College. Keisho Scott is a former Black Panther. She'll give us her reflections on this anniversary when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Key. For my guests, former State Representative Wayne Ford, the longest-serving African-American in the state legislature, served from 97 until 2010. Also in our Des Moines studio, Reverend Milton Cole Duvall of West Des Moines, both helping us remember the March on Washington. Commemorating that today took place on August 28, 1963. Over 200,000 people attended. Some say the number was closer to a quarter million or even 500,000. And many credit this march for the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It was a particularly hot day in Washington. 1963, the Red Cross treated well over 1,000 people from heat exhaustion, dehydration. Happened that 1963 was also the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation by the president then, President Lincoln, in 1863 during the Civil War, which freed the slaves. It's also best remembered, this event, for a speech given by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., known as the I Have a Dream speech.
It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred.
An excerpt from the I Have a Dream speech given by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. this week, 50 years ago. Also joining us now, Keisho Scott by phone, Associate Professor of American Studies and Sociology at Grinnell College. She's been at Grinnell for nearly 30 years, an internationally renowned diversity trainer and consultant, also an award-winning writer. Keisho Scott, so glad you could join us. I believe you're in Boston, right?
I'm in Boston. Can you hear me well?
Oh, loud and clear. Thank you for joining us, Keisho. We played a little clip there. We're remembering what happened 50 years ago, and I think you've been listening to our program thus far this hour. What jumps to mind for you as far as reflections when we commemorate this historic day?
Well, first of all, I have been listening, and it has been really an honor to hear the other guests share their personal experiences with either being there or talking about the moment. So what jumps out at me is for me to share a little bit about what was I doing.
Yes, please do.
That's... All right. Well, I was 10 years old. I was living in Detroit, Michigan. I was with a single parent. My mother was an uneducated woman, and the issue of jobs was very important. So for her to be tuning in to such a speech, it was to give her some idea about how she could fight job discrimination as a black woman in predominantly black Detroit. And I remember getting a sort of earful from my mother about her critique of that speech. So that's sort of a setting for me.
Mm-hmm. We have a Keisho. If you don't mind, I want to turn to former State Representative Wayne Ford. Wayne Ford, you have to leave in a couple minutes, and we want to not just to have you disappear, but tell you we really appreciate you taking part in our program today. Do you have any thoughts to leave us with before you go?
Well, thank you very much for that. And again, it's a pleasure to be part of this show. As serving as a legislator, I'm very proud that when I did the history about Iowa and knowing that we were doing so many progressive things here, I was very fortunate enough to do a bill, Minority Impact Statement Bill, that that Governor Culver signed in 2010. And it was the right now Iowa is the only state in the nation that requires a minority impact study. That means any bill that we would do toward judicial or correction or building a new prison has to go by a test, a litmus test, to see how it affects minorities. And here in Iowa, minorities is female, disabled, black, white, everybody. I mean, to be candid. So minorities are very large, group here. And so some of my work that started as a kid in D.C., listened to that speech, I have lived long enough to, as a legislator, take the spirit that I received as an 11-year-old kid and leave it here in the state. It's on the books now. We're the first state in the country. I believe Iowa will continue to be a progressive state. Yes, we got many challenges. I can go on and on and on. We can do that on another time. But when I look at the essence of Iowa and the history of Iowa and knowing that Martin Luther King here came here in Des Moines, in Drake, and went around this state, it tells me a lot about the people of Iowa, black and white, good people. Thank you for this opportunity.
Wayne Ford, thank you for coming into our studio. We appreciate it. Keisho Scott, let me go back to you. You mentioned your mother's critique on that day, watching the television of the speakers at the Washington march. What was your mother's critique? What do you remember about that?
I think the most important thing that I remember is that my mother, I don't think she used these words, but they're directly in Martin Luther King's speech, where he talks about making crooked places straight. I love that part. And what that is about is, if the Civil War was to resolve the question of slavery and economic development in the United States, the civil rights activities were to resolve and end 100 years of racial segregation, which was legal in the United States, our form of legal apartheid in the United States. My mother was saying that when that legal apartheid is eliminated, she will have access to jobs. Mm-hmm. And what I'd like to link that up is with what our Representative Ford said, that I'm somebody that later began to realize that, you know, could our activities only come about the solutions in voting? So thus, I evolved to be somebody who became part of the Black Panther Party, which has its roots in voter registration of people in the South. So I think the film The Butler is sort of showing people a piece of history. And I think Iowa was very progressive because it wasn't a slave state. So I'm kind of piecing all of those things together to say that my mother's reflections weren't just about ending segregation, but they were also about having economic opportunities.
When we heard that excerpt a moment ago from Dr. Martin Luther King, he ended by making a plea for, in very elegant terms, for nonviolence. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking of the cup of bitterness and hatred.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you were a former Black Panther. I think in your teens you were that. Was that a tenet of the Black Panthers? If so, maybe is it misremembered in history?
I think that there is a tremendous misrepresentative of the Black Panther organization. Like any organization, it has stages. The Black Panther originally was set up to do voter registration in the South, and they took the symbol of the Black Panther because many of the Southern African Americans could not read and write, but they could see the symbol of the Panther. So that's just a piece of history. The Black Panther Party became a defense party when it moved its programs to the northern part of the country, and the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the disillusionment of many African Americans to expect white leadership to represent them in the political causes, and the race riots that took place in 161 cities in the United States. So the Black Panther Party became one of the center places in the northern cities for people to say, well, maybe we need black power. And black power in its initial element was to say, we can also give leadership to our country too. By the way, there is a part in the speech where Dr. King really says to us, we want to be able to sing that song, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, and it has the same meaning to us. Well, you know, many of these songs of our national heritage and many of those promises of those original documents, we didn't benefit as people, as African-American people. And so I think that the Black Panther was raising the questions early on now of maybe we need to have African-American leadership as part of the American dream. And this was, of course, a very provocative idea.
Keisho Scott is with us of Grinnell College. Also with us, Reverend Milton Cole Duvall of West Des Moines. He was at that famous March of Washington 50 years ago. Let me ask you first, Keisho, then perhaps turn to the Reverend on this one, too. When you talk about the passage you just mentioned, also when we talk about the passage where the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. talks about all of God's children, is it true, is it not, that there were no women speakers at this march?
There were no women speakers at this march, but we now know from archival work that there were many people that the original idea was that they would have a woman speaker at the March on Washington, but there was a lot of internal debate with the organization as to whether that would get a credibility. So it isn't that the issues that Martin Luther King raised weren't relevant. It's just that they were trying to make political, I'm not making excuses, but they were trying to make a political decision about, you know, who would be better heard. And so they didn't choose a woman speaker at that time, but there were initially several women who were suggested.
Reverend Cole Duvall, you were there. Did it occur to you at the time watching it that there were no women speaking?
It did. I took note of that. There were several women who sang. Mahalia Jackson sang. Odetta sang. Marian Anderson sang. But in retrospect, history has revealed that Merle Edgars had been earmarked to be a speaker. Her husband had been killed earlier that summer, and she was not able to make her way to D.C. There were a handful of women, one of them being Rosa Parks, that were introduced from the staging area. But it was very obvious to me that oftentimes in the heat of the night, the people that had been abused but stood tall, especially when their husbands were taken away, sold, were women. And it was very noticeable to me that women did not operate a relative significant aspect of the gathering.
Reverend Cole Duvall and Keisho Scott, I'd like to play another excerpt from that famous speech given by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. At this time, and just play it and then ask you a little bit about the effect that it has on you today, 50 years later. This is the final moments of the I Have a Dream speech during the March on Washington in August of 1963.
And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Keisho Scott, let me go to you first. What are you feeling? 50 years ago, it doesn't get old to hear it again, does it?
No, it doesn't get old. And having spent 30 years doing diversity work, first starting in Iowa, and diversity work is on the one hand about recognizing the multicultural diversity of the very beginning of the United States and even current, you know, diversity in the United States, and also doing inclusion work, and that is rooting out the rest of those crooked places that Dr. King talked about.
You do. You have a technique. You have a technique. I think called unlearning racism, where you facilitate this.
Absolutely. And I think when you ask me about my feelings, what is so has always been wonderful about doing Unlearning Racism work is that often the moment in which people recognize that they've been part of a process that is hurtful to others, they're more than willing to put their energy to make changes. But all of us have to sort of be confronted with sort of that misinformation that we've had about others. So that speech, free at last, is to me about that ongoing recognition that the struggle continues, that it's an agenda that we take into the 21st century, and that it's about doing inclusion work. So it's now not just the white and black paradigm, but it is all the other ways that we see the binaries that include and exclude people. And I think it's still a very passionate and powerful agenda for all of us.
Reverend Cole Duvall, free at last. What does that mean to you?
Well, picking up on it's more than Dr. King's poetic cadence of the moment. We fast forward to 2013. We are not all free at last, especially when we see that systematically people in Florida and North Carolina and Texas and New Hampshire are voting to limit hard-fought rights to vote, cutting back on hours, delimiting places of voting, having people to have identification cards. We're not free at last. We're taking two steps backwards. But the march continues. We fall down, we stumble, but somebody like Kesho picks me up, and I might offer my hand to Mr. Ford, and the struggle continues. So from Dr. King's cadence, we receive our marching orders to move on. I do believe that in difficult times, good ultimately does prevail. But for those who are being systematically deprived of goodness at the time, it's hard to always know or believe that. But those who have experienced the struggle are hopeful people, and they hope in the ultimate goodness of all people, and that good will ultimately win out.
Tomorrow, the nation's first African-American president will stand on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and give a speech where Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. stood 50 years earlier. Kesho Scott, do you ever compare Barack Obama and Martin Luther King Jr. in your mind? Inevitably, it's done in the media, of course. How do they compare in your mind?
You know, actually, I don't compare them. I see them as representing different places on the American timeline and the chance for every American to get a piece of the American dream. So I don't compare them. I see it more as a continued representation of hopefully making democracy more available to every person and freedom and justice. Now, having said that, I think that Dr. King was responding to a set of contradictions during racial segregation, where my president, our president, is addressing larger economic and political issues of America in a global moment, and also addressing, you know, a period of sort of post-civil rights and post-inclusion and the new contradictions that have emerged in this period. By the way, remember that the original focus of the March on Washington was for jobs as well as freedom. So I think our president is addressing some of those larger issues of unemployment, inclusion, exclusion, protecting the rights that people fought for, you know, as we heard, you know, Reverend Cole Duvall talk about. These things are still on the table, but they have slightly different shifts. And I think he's leader of the free world, and he's addressing those within the context of bringing his raced experience to this office of leadership as an American president. Big challenge. And mm-hmm. and we will all be standing back in the next years when he's no longer president, sort of asking ourselves, how did he do in expanding democracy?
Right.
I think that's exciting.
Reverend Cole Duvall, we have about a minute left to talk about the future, what you see as the future of civil rights, perhaps what you'd like to see hear from President Obama as he highlights tomorrow Martin Luther King Jr.'s economic agenda marking the 50th anniversary of the march.
Well, for me, it's an opportunity. Tomorrow will be an opportunity to look back, look at where we are, and look at where we might be. Tomorrow I'm going to spend a couple hours at my wife's church in silence and remember those martyrs that went before us, Emmett Till, Dr. King, Mr. Evers, and civil rights fighters in Philadelphia, Mississippi. I'm going to ponder where we are now and how we might move forward. I'm a person of unbounding hope, unbounding belief in the American dream. But it's not going to happen without people speaking out boldly, people like Keisho, people like Wayne, speaking out and reminding others of us of our challenge. No one person can do it all. Keisho, she might want to take a week off. So I might be so bold as to think I could stand up and fill her high heel shoes for an hour or two. Bold, white, clueless white man that I am.
But Keisho, do you wear high heels?
Absolutely not. I wear Birkenstocks.
Okay.
But he's right. He's saying, I got your back.
We have to go. Keisho Scott, thank you so much. Of Grinnell College, Reverend Milton Cole Duval of West Des Moines. It's been a pleasure having you.
It was an honor for me to be here today. It was an honor to sit beside Wayne Ford, a true leader in our state, and Keisho Scott, an amazing woman in her own right.
And I would only ditto that. It's been an absolute honor. Thanks, Ben, for giving me a chance to be part of this program.
Keisho Scott, Reverend Cole Duval, thank you very much. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Support from Dennis Reese as well. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.